Why is Stephen Colbert the number one host in late night television?
He's not. Greg Gutfeld is.
No. So Gutfeld is, that's part of what I was going to talk about. So Gutfeld, I actually wrote a story a couple years ago when Gutfeld was really making inroads. And I'm a huge like Red Eye fan from back in the day. And I've been on Gutfeld a couple times. It's super fun and it does have that late night vibe. And he is really creeping up on Stephen Colbert. He's beaten him in several metrics for several stretches of time. Stephen Colbert still has an edge like annually, right? So we'll look back on this year and it's possible Greg Gutfeld will have beat Stephen Colbert, and that's the point. Stephen Colbert has been the number one host in late night despite being the least funny person on late night television for several years. Not only is he the least funny, he's actually also just the most political. And that used to be a very, late night comedy used to be a very different thing. It's not that Johnny Carson wasn't political, it's that Johnny Carson was neutral. Right, and Johnny Carson is what we would call an equal opportunity offender. He had fun with everybody. Why is that? Well, maybe because Johnny Carson was just a great guy, but it was also the business model. We have come through the age of mass media, but we have not dispensed with the pretenses. And that's extremely important. It's some of what Alyssa was talking about, but we don't realize yet that the pretense of neutrality doesn't exist anymore. We are all splintering into this fragmented media landscape, and the corporate media refuses to relinquish their title of being neutral, although some of them you'll hear more and more arguments against the just sort of neutrality as an intellectual concept. But this is really interesting because in Johnny Carson's day, he would put up around, 10, 15 million in the ratings on any given night. So Gutfeld and Colbert, who are the two most successful people in late night TV right now, they're around 3 million. That happened in our culture really, really quickly. We went from having touchstones that everybody was watching and reading at the same time to all of us watching. I mean, in any given night, you don't have to watch Colbert. You can watch Johnny Carson from any given night in 1975. The choices are endless. And so with that means we are losing our cultural touchstones. So Johnny Carson's writers used to have to sit around and say, what will make America laugh tonight? Now, Stephen Colbert's writers have to sit down and say, what will make liberal boomers laugh tonight? Or even Greg Gutfeld, who I think does great comedy, it's not like he has to appeal to 15 million people. So he says, what is going to make my demo laugh tonight? What are the other people not doing that I should be doing? So we're asking some very different questions, and the products are naturally very, very different. And because it happens so quickly, we are adjusting to that. Like, we don't totally realize, if you grew up in the era of even Jay Leno, you're still not used to this idea that, my goodness, Jon Stewart is pulling a lot of viewers away and everyone is watching different things at 11 p.m. That's a very different country. And that's everything that Amanda was saying about our myths and about just our messages and our experience as the United States of America, that has had a huge impact on it. And again, we still haven't fully realized that the numbers are that dramatically different. And mass media really necessitated neutrality. So that's how you go from Walter Cronkite sort of slowly to Dan Rather to Lester Holt, who has openly said that fairness is overrated. I mean, think about that. If Walter Cronkite had said that fairness is overrated, his career would have ended that day in incredible shame, right? It would be over. But that's not how the media works anymore. Lester Holt can say that and get away with it, but actually get awarded for it because his network doesn't need him to be putting up the same numbers anymore. And because this is the part that's sort of, in the sense that this is a confluence of really, I think, dangerous factors. On the one hand, you have the splintering of mass media without us realizing that that's what's happened. And on the other hand, you have the rise of what I have called the progressive or bigot binary. This is the idea. You can go back to academics. You can trace it, you know, back years and years and years. It's been festering in the fringes in academia for years and years. And as we started filtering more and more young people through our system of higher education, and as higher education had this idea that if you are not fully progressive with every breath you take, you are necessarily a bigot. And that is really what these books say. If you read them, if you read Robin DiAngelo, if you read the people who birthed Robin DiAngelo intellectually, this has been something that's around for a really, really long time. And as we sent more and more students, we filtered them through our system of higher education. And then as we started sorting, as Charles Murray has described, into sort of elite bubbles, super zips, you now have this very culturally radical contingent that is running our institutions. And this is not news to anybody here. We all sort of understand that. We know that the newsroom and the boardroom and the writer's room is now the classroom, right? Like we know, we understand that that's happened. But when you mix it together with the splintering of mass media, things are getting really weird, right? Like the culture is getting really weird, but there's some good news to all of that. Joe Rogan is the new Walter Cronkite, and I am not, like, it sounds funny, but it's true. It's absolutely true, and Joe Rogan is not conservative. And there are a ton of people who are in this space who are not conservative, and that isn't to say conservatives aren't having a huge impact. I mean, Ben Shapiro is one of the most popular podcasts in the world. Ben Shapiro, and I cannot tell you the number of young people that I have talked to, even liberal kids, who listen to Ben Shapiro all the time. And I can't tell you, I mean, in my own family, people who have sort of come out of, you know, their teenage hazes and found Ben Shapiro and just had the right values and right ideas. It's really interesting. And the other thing I would say in this space that sort of goes with what Alyssa was talking about, who on earth would have thought that Jordan Peterson's book would have been a runaway bestseller? Another person who's not really conservative, right? Like, not a political Republican, right? That's not how we would classify Jordan Peterson to the extent that he can be classified. But that book spoke to something that people were not getting. So obviously there's huge market opportunity because people are so sick of the big budget James Bond garbage that, let's not say, the right should not be promoting spy propaganda, period. I thought that was a great point, Amanda. But they're so sick of sort of feminized heroes and are starving for something masculine that can help sort of socialize their kids in accordance with their values and in accordance with human values. I mean, we're talking like we're getting into a transhumanist phase of the country. And there's something really powerful kicking back in the form of Joe Rogan interviewing like Jewel and getting millions and millions of views for talking about homesteading for 3 hours. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's truly unbelievable. So those are the two, I would say those, that confluence is extremely, extremely important to think about. The media is catering more and more to smaller niches, and they're keeping us there, which is the exact opposite of what's happening, interestingly enough, in the movie scene, because they're generalizing everything, right? Exactly as Amanda described, the scripts have to be translatable, they're walking away from humor because it doesn't translate very well, and they're globalizing the themes and the values and all of that. But here in this country, we are being kept in niches because that's how you make money. If you corner the niche on cringe, boomer resistance comedy, you'll be the number one host in late night. And that's worked really well for Stephen Colbert. And, you know, so as we cluster in these niches, we are going to share fewer and fewer cultural touchstones. That is enormously dangerous at a time when we are also divided along cultural lines, along socioeconomic lines, in more and more salient ways. There was a study that just came out by AEI and the Wheatley Institution and the Institute for Family Studies just last week, talking about how people in higher income brackets are exiting the pandemic much more likely to want children, much more likely to get married. And that flips some on its head, the children part, with people in lower income brackets to where it's always been. But what's interesting about that is it shows how different, and that was applied also for Republicans and people who are religious. So these things that used to bring people together are now really, really keeping us apart, and in ways that aren't just numbers on a chart, but are actually our popular culture, and our popular stories, and our popular myths, and our identity as a country. So I don't mean to be sort of a bummer. I feel like everybody has said that. But I will say, something to think about is that there is enormous opportunity. The splintering of the media means the barrier to entry. The gatekeepers are not the stodgy old, not that Alyssa is stodgy and old, but I was pointing to her because of the New York Times, like, or they're not the Simon & Schuster, stodgy old Simon & Schuster gatekeepers who used to say, yeah, no. You want to make an argument in favor of traditional marriage? No, I don't like you very much. It's not worth it, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the good news. There are parallel institutions being built up, like what the Daily Wire is doing. Alyssa's shipping me out to Montana to check out the set for Gina Carano's movie. And that's an example of a parallel institution. She is a bona fide celebrity. Someone that you also might not classify as like a traditional conservative or Republican, but can make art along the lines of what Amanda was talking about that will actually sort of strengthen our popular culture and our national identity and some of these singular American ideas and values. So there is good news in all of this, but I think keeping in mind that sort of lens of media fragmentation is really, really important, and that's it.